I never thought that I would give a talk that would be in part sponsored by Boeing. Please mail them a copy of this talk or send them a recording. I just spent 2 years with the great graphic illustrator Joe Sacco, who I had met in Bosnia in 1995 when I was covering the war there for the New York Times, and he was doing his book, A Safe Area, Garajda. I was not at the time particularly literate with the form of graphic novels, but I certainly recognized a first-rate journalist when I saw one. We subsequently collaborated on a long story for Harper's Magazine, where we went and lived in a refugee camp in Gaza, Khan Yunis, and then did a piece for The Nation magazine out of Camden. This book had its genesis in the last two books that I wrote, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle, which was a look at how we have been effectively unplugged from the reality around us. I think we're probably the most illusioned society on the planet. The mantra that reality is never an impediment to what we want, which is fed to us across the political and cultural spectrum, whether that's Oprah or the Christian right or positive psychology or self-help gurus or Hollywood. And of course, it's a form not only of magical thinking, but infantilism. It essentially creates a population that never grows up. And as that gap opens up between the illusion of who we think we are and where we think we're headed and the reality, when that gap widens to such an extent that reality is no longer deniable, when it's our home that is foreclosed, when we finally grasp that that job that we lost is not coming back and will never appear for our children, there is a tendency in such societies to react as children, which is to call for a demagogue, a savior, moral renewal, and vengeance. And I think we see on the outer fringes of American society, embodied in groups like the Tea Party and militias and a lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, and just about anybody who speaks on Fox News, that this frightening form of proto-fascism is very real. The next book that I wrote was Death of the Liberal Class, which looked at the pillars of the liberal establishment. What happened? How did we reach a point where we had become disempowered? And that book led me back to World War I, which I think was a seminal moment in American history, because on the eve of the war, you had numerous radical, populist, progressive movements that were threatening the control of the power elite. We had over 70 socialist mayors in this country. Appeal to Reason had the fourth highest circulation, a socialist journal. Eugene Debs in 1912 pulled 6%, 900,000 votes. And as Dwight MacDonald, a writer I admire very much, pointed out, the war was the rock on which these movements broke, because what was instituted was the system, the first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission, because it was led by a former muckraking journalist named George Creel, which employed for the first time the understandings of crowd psychology pioneered by Le Bon, Trotter, and Sigmund Freud. And Edward Bernays, the father of modern public relations, comes out of the Creel Commission, Freud's nephew through marriage twice over. His book, After the War, Propaganda, becomes a seminal text that Goebbels uses when building the Nazi propaganda machine. And it was this understanding that people were not moved by fact or reason, but by the manipulation of emotion, what Walter Lippmann in his book Public Opinion calls the manufacturing of consent. That is where Chomsky and Herman get the title for their book on the media a few decades later. When you read Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams, who held out against this propaganda, and the Creel Commission had, of course, the resources of the state, public speakers fanned out across the country. It had its own news division, which pumped out daily press pro-war press stories. It had its own film division, which made movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin, and stuff like this. The debate, it's interesting, the debate at the beginning when they were first going into the war between Wilson and Lippmann, and that argument over whether they would have to use the coercive measures of the Espionage Act or the Sedition Act to control the population. The war had very little popular support, and of course we were pushed into the war because of the Wall Street, collapse of the Eastern Front. The collapse of Tsarist Russia raised the specter that the Kaiser could move over 100 divisions over to the Western Front, and if Germany and France, or excuse me, Britain and France were defeated, then those tremendous loans that Wall Street had given Britain and France would never be repaid. I mean, this was really a banker's war. There's sort of nothing new in that. When Bourne and Adams write, they talk about, in fact, how easily the intellectual and even the radical class is seduced into the war effort. That's a constant theme in their writings, that kind of despair. So, in fact, the harsher measures of control were really reserved for those recalcitrant few who were not seduced by the propaganda. Debs himself, of course, who ends up in prison under Wilson. And the war effectively begins the dismantling of radical and populist movements, which is absolutely, a crucial turning point in American history. Those movements, it's only been movements that have, and Zinn does a very good job of pointing this out in the People's History of the United States, which I teach at a correctional facility, and there is some benefit to having an illiterate ruling class. I submitted my form to teach the inmates American history, and the prison officials thought this was just wonderful. And then I went out and bought every inmate a copy of The People's History of the United States. I never met Zinn, a huge admirer of him, but after teaching him to African-American inmates, I realized what a magnificent moral and intellectual voice he was. I would give 90-minute talks built around whatever chapter we were studying, and I would hear inmates go, "Damn, damn, we've been lied to." But Zinn's very cognizant that, you know, the founding fathers, which are sort of deified often by the liberal class along with the ruling class, never wanted a popular democracy. They were terrified of popular democracy. Of course, they disenfranchised the majority of people in this country, African Americans, Native Americans, women, people without property, indentured servants, and then created mechanisms within the system like the Electoral College and the Senate, where the senators used to be appointed, so that popular rule would never be achieved. And the magnificence of Zinn's work is this study of how that opening up of American society was obtained with the sweat, toil, sacrifice, and blood of the disenfranchised and the American working class. And so the power elite certainly understood the danger of these movements, and they used the war to break them. Dwight MacDonald writes after that moment after the war of a transition in American society from into what he calls the psychosis of permanent war. And he says none of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Karl Marx, anticipated this psychosis of permanent war where, in MacDonald's words, you can get the masses to call for their own enslavement. So after the war, the dreaded Hun becomes the dreaded Red. Everybody from the Committee for Public Information goes straight to Madison Avenue and starts working on behalf of corporations. And they upend traditional American values of self-effacement, thrift, community, to instill this cult of the self, hedonism, and consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. They effectively, I think when we talk about American values or American culture, at this point what we're really talking about is corporate culture. And they used the Espionage and the Sedition Act to essentially wipe out those radical movements that were left behind, including the Wobblies. Big Bill Haywood has to flee the country, spends the last decade of his life in Moscow. Joe Hill, of course, is on trumped-up murder charges, hung in Utah. The masses is shut down, appeal to reason is shut down. Even though there was a policy during the war that you could only publish if you had a pro-war editorial stance, which is why the masses wouldn't publish, appeal to reason did, and even then they were shut down. That's how you have Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman deported. So the breaking of those radical movements was accompanied by the disemboweling of the liberal class itself in the name of anti-communism, culminating, of course, with the witch hunts, the Red Scare of the 1950s, when everything was obliterated. Thousands of university professors, high school teachers, social workers. It used to be that social workers would, the unions would advocate on behalf of their clients, artists, writers, directors, journalists like I.F. Stone, who becomes a pariah. He can't even get a job at The Nation magazine, and he ends up starting I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement. And so the progressive forces are pushed out. The liberal forces are hollowed out. Figures like Sidney Hook, who had flirted with Trotskyism, becomes, he names names. And the liberal class itself ceases to function. The function of the liberal class, of course, is not to serve as the political left in a capitalist democracy. The function of the liberal class is to serve as a safety valve. So when then grievances and injustices become extensive within the underclass, it makes possible incremental or piecemeal reform. And that's why when Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. The breakdown of the liberal class means that that incremental reform is no longer possible. And it's interesting that this is a constant theme in Dostoevsky's work. At the end of the 19th century in Russia, that's what his novel Demons is about. That's what Notes from Underground is about. It's Mouse Man. It's the defeated dreamer who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," and now is just cynical and in despair. And Dostoevsky says when that liberal center doesn't work, when essentially you have a government that is gripped by paralysis, which is something that I saw in the former Yugoslavia, then you enter an age of moral nihilism. So without the populist movements and without, in the end, a functioning liberal class that was able to safeguard some of the interests of the vulnerable within the society, and, of course, the working class, you give rise to these monstrosities such as Bill Clinton. Clinton speaks in that traditional feel-your-pain, like Obama, feel-your-pain language of liberalism and yet serves corporate interests. So under Clinton, we get the destruction of welfare. We get the deregulation of the FCC, which is not a small act because it essentially has allowed a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, Clear Channel, to buy up the airwaves. And we've been reduced in this political theater to investing our emotional energy in what is nothing more than court gossip. And that's what MSNBC does, and that's what Fox does. They spin it in a different direction. But it's the same inanities, whether it's Newt's moon colonies or Ann Romney's horse. The real issues that confront the American citizens as they are rapidly stripped of power are never addressed over the commercial airwaves. And of course, it's Clinton who destroys the banking system, which triggers the economic meltdown of 2008. But Clinton was well paid for it. So by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and when Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, he got more. And so the obvious question is, with all of the restraints and impediments lifted against corporate capitalism, with nothing to check that predatory nature of corporate capitalism, what happens? And what Joe and I did was go to the sacrifice zones of the country, those places that had been offered up to the marketplace first. And of course, it all began with westward expansion and the seizure of the land, the violation of the treaties, and the acts of genocide carried out against Native Americans, propelled by gold speculators, timber speculators, freighters, the railroad barons. And what you saw in the final stages of the crushing of Native culture was not simply the seizure of land and the decimation of a peoples, but the destruction of a competing ethic of how to exist on the planet. Within Native societies, anybody who hoarded goods for themselves was despised. Everything was communal, and there was an understanding that life was sacred, including the natural world. Carl Polanyi, in 1944, wrote a great book called The Great Transformation about unfettered capitalism, which, like Marx, he calls a revolutionary force that has built within it its own quality of self-destruction. Because, as Polanyi writes, when you commodify everything, when human beings become a commodity, when the natural world becomes a commodity, you exploit those forces until exhaustion or collapse, which is why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. These sacrifice zones, we were in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, are forms of violence. And the violence visited by the forces of oppression on those who live within these sacrifice zones destroys their capacity to sustain themselves both economically and morally. The average life expectancy of a male on Pine Ridge is 48. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. There is an estimated 80% alcoholism rate, and at any one time, 60% of the dwellings have neither electricity or water. And of course, these people, like all the people in our sacrifice zones, are invisible. And that's why, for me, it was so important to work with Joe. Over 50 pages of the book are graphic panels. He can give a kind of filmic quality to lives and illustrations to make those who live within in these zones visible to the reader in a way that in simple prose is often difficult. We then went to Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, and also, not surprisingly, one of the most dangerous. Most urban centers have fallen into decay, but some parts of those urban centers remain functional. In Camden, it is a completely dead city, and this was one of the industrial hubs of the Northeast. At its height, the shipyards in Camden employed 36,000 people. RCA Victor was there. Campbell's Soup was there. And in Camden, everything went. There are whole blocks that are just deserted, with literally trees growing out of the roofs. The only two businesses that function are the roughly 100 open-air drug markets. And this huge scrap metal business on the river, because you have armies of foragers who go into the abandoned buildings and rip out all the piping and the screen doors, anything, bring it down to the port where it's crushed up, and ships from China, Turkey, India come and literally take the guts of this American city overseas to smelt it down. We went from there to West Virginia, the coal fields, in southern West Virginia, where coal companies who own everyone, all politicians, I mean, they even write the school textbooks so that big coal is painted in classrooms as sort of the savior of West Virginia. And because they don't want to dig down for coal anymore, they just blow the top 400 feet off of the mountains to get to the coal seams. They are doing this with some of the largest land equipment on earth, 25-foot story drag lines, giant bulldozers, and they will literally push all of the trees and topsoil over the edge and light it on fire. And we flew over this wasteland. And these are the lungs of the eastern seaboard. Much of the headwaters of the eastern seaboard come out of the Appalachian Mountains. And it's just a moonscape with raging lit fires. It's an act of collective suicide for quarterly profit. And of course, the consequences are that the air is poisoned, the water is poisoned. We went into villages in southern West Virginia where everybody has had their gallbladder removed because the water is so toxic. You walk into the nurse's office in an elementary school, and there are rows of little inhalers for the children. Cancer is an epidemic, and self-medication to cope with that despair, hillbilly heroin, is widespread. Oxycontin. We are people we interviewed in the book who, young men who a few weeks later had died of overdoses. That sort of bifurcation in these sacrifice zones into either anesthetizing yourself through opiates, alcohol, it was either that or clinging to religious belief. And not necessarily Christian. In Pine Ridge, it was Lakota traditions, sweat lodges. We went to a Sundance, deeply moving, 4 days of fasting, dancing around a cottonwood tree, young men often with their prison tattoos, struggling to pull their lives back together. In all of those pockets, there were figures, heroic figures, who resisted and yet did within the book articulate how power worked. And it wasn't that they necessarily had hope that they could overcome the forces arrayed against them. But as Hannah Arendt understood, she said that finally when one embraces the moral life, it's not done by those who say I shouldn't or I oughtn't, but it's done by those who say I can't. The fourth chapter was out of Immokalee, Florida, the produce fields, because, as Bernie Sanders said after he visited Immokalee, in the race to the bottom that has become America, Immokalee is the bottom. There you have the perfect worker in the corporate state, utterly disempowered, no legal rights, no benefits, no protection. When they don't work, if they can't, they have to. There's three families in Immokalee that control the trailer parks. These are trailers that should have been condemned years ago. Holes in the floorboards, rats, cockroaches. They'll put 20 mattresses down on the floor, and you pay $50 a week. That's $2,000 a month these people are making to live in that trailer, and then you have to go to the collection points at 4 in the morning and hope that crew leaders pick you, put them on the bus, and take you out to the fields. And if you can't work enough that week and turn in your $50, you sleep under a mango tree or out on the outskirts of the town in a wooded area in places that we visited. And it's not surprising that there are just constant discoveries of slavery, where workers are held against their will. Their families are threatened in Mexico or Honduras or Guatemala if they report to authorities, and we interviewed some of them. Sometimes those slave encampments can run into a few hundred workers who are often held behind barbed wire. And as corporations, you know, have been able to reconfigure American society into a form of neo-feudalism, which, of course, they're doing with the global economy, you're finding the horrific conditions that workers, undocumented workers, endure in our produce fields being replicated in all sorts of other industries, from the hotel industry to meatpacking to everything else. And that's because we've lost the capacity to fight back through the formal mechanisms of power. The liberal establishment has essentially sold its soul. And here I would disagree with Thomas Franks in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, where he argues that, he asks, why is it that these people vote against their own interests? I don't think they vote against their own interests. Of course, most people in this country just don't vote. I think they fully understand that the Democratic Party, especially after NAFTA, walked out on the working class of this country, turned their back on the working class in this country. And the sort of destruction, the internal destruction, I think it's what, 5 or 7% of jobs in this country are now manufacturing jobs. And the New York Times did a story a couple weeks ago where they looked at those middle-class families that had lost their jobs in 2008 and found that in most cases, those who had found new jobs were working for salaries that were 40 or 50% less than what they were making before without benefits. And that's, of course, where we're headed. We've shifted, we shifted in the 1970s, I suppose, from what the Harvard historian Charles Mayer calls an empire of production into an empire of consumption. And so the Obama administration, which has been nothing if not obsequious to corporate interests, and if any of you have followed Obamacare, you know fully what I'm speaking about. This health bill was hatched within the Heritage Foundation, which should be a huge tip-off to you that it's no good. It was first implemented in 2006 by then-Governor Romney. It then made its way to Washington, where its 2,000 pages were tweaked and written by corporate lobbyists who inserted, of course, $447 billion in subsidies. That's why this is the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industries and why, of course, stocks today of pharmaceutical insurance industries have shot through the roof. They can still jack up copayments and premiums. If you get a serious illness, you're still not protected. And, of course, 1 million bankruptcies a year in this country are caused by people who can't pay their medical bills, and 80% of them had insurance. And the tragedy for me is that it's going to make it even harder for us to get the public option or Medicare for all, which is the only rational policy that should be implemented. One of the things that has frightened me most about the Obama administration is its egregious assault against civil liberties, which are actually worse than the Bush administration. And that's because the corporate state, I think if we have to date the final act of the corporate coup d'etat, it's probably 2010 with Citizens United. The corporate state is fully aware of what is happening. And they are rapidly criminalizing dissent, as Rahm Emanuel did in Chicago, because they know that as they harvest the country, it's a business term where you take over a business, you know it's not going to last, and you just squeeze it for short-term profit, that eventually there will be a backlash. So that's why Obama has not restored habeas corpus. That's why he supported the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping and monitoring and eavesdropping of tens of millions of Americans. And now we all know where your information is stored in supercomputers in Utah. That has permitted him to radically, I think, misinterpret the 2001 authorization to use Military Force Act to call for the assassination or carry out the assassination of American citizens, and then 2 weeks later, their 16-year-old son. And that's what has caused Obama to use the Espionage Act 6 times against whistleblowers including Sterling, who purportedly gave information about war crimes to the New York Times. The Espionage Act was never designed to silence whistleblowers. In between 1917, when it was passed, and the Obama administration, it was only used three times against whistleblowers, the first being Daniel Ellsberg. And I have many friends who are investigative journalists, and they all will tell you that essentially no one within the structures of power will speak to them anymore, because Obama has essentially delivered the message that if you talk, you're probably going to go to prison. And this also, of course, is what led Obama to pass or sign into law on New Year's Eve the National Defense Authorization Act, which included Section 1021, which, until I sued him and we won in federal court, was law. But read it. It's terrifying. It authorizes or gives the government the power to use the military to seize American citizens on American soil, hold them in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies, strip them of due process, and it's not just terrorists. It's citizens who have relationships with what they call, quote-unquote, associated forces, whatever that is, to hold them in these military facilities until, in the language of that section of the bill, the end of hostilities, which, of course, is indefinite. It's forever. And Dianne Feinstein, to her credit, when she read it, attempted to insert language into that section to exempt American citizens, and both the Obama White House and the Democratic Party rejected it. And fortunately, we had a courageous judge in the Southern District Court of New York, Catherine Forrest, who threw it out and issued a temporary injunction which essentially invalidates that section of the act, and we're waiting now to see whether the government will challenge it and it'll move to an appellate court. And the last chapter of this book, the book was always called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. But when we began it, the revolt was conjecture. We certainly understood that with all restraints lifted on corporations, there would eventually be a response. But we didn't know what the response would look like. We didn't know when it would come. We didn't know where it would come from. And then September 17th happened in Zuccotti Park. And it made palpable what over the last 2 years had been posited, but something we couldn't show. And so I've spent a lot of time in Zuccotti. We went to Zuccotti, and the last chapter of the book is the Occupy movement. The only hope that we have now of challenging these corporate forces is by rebuilding mass movements. It is not going to come by placing a naive faith within the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, or the judicial system. That corporate coup is over. And for me, that's why Occupy was so important. It articulated the fundamental problem, which is that corporate power has seized control of our economy, control of our political system, and control of our systems of information, not to mention our systems of education. And it's only by building a mass movement that we have any hope of bringing them down. It appears quixotic, and yet I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe, including East Germany, which was the most efficient police state, certainly in Eastern Europe, perhaps in the world, the Stasi state. For every 63 East Germans, there was a police informant. And what happened, and it's one of the reasons that I've been so critical of the Black Bloc anarchists, what happened is that you saw these courageous and lonely dissidents in Leipzig, mostly coming out of Lutheran churches, carrying out candlelit vigils against the regime of Erich Honecker, who had been in power for 19 years. And then suddenly a few hundred people joined them, and then a few thousand, and then East Berlin saw that there were 70,000 people marching through the streets of Leipzig. And they sent down an elite paratroop division to shoot the crowd. And when the officers went into the barracks to get the paratroopers, many of them were weeping because they had family and friends on the streets. Honecker sent that paratroop division down to Leipzig, and it never shot the demonstrators. At that point, he did not last another week in power. When you can pull those kinds of numbers into the streets, including 500,000 people in Alexanderplatz and East Berlin, who are nonviolent, who speak a fundamental truth about the corruption of power, what you do is you paralyze the forces that the ruling elite relies on for control. You draw those forces to you. And this is true in most revolutions. I mean, the Russian Revolution was in fact a nonviolent revolution. The violence came afterwards when Western powers backed the White Army that led to the Civil War, and Lenin and the Bolsheviks carried out a push to overthrow the Constitutional Assembly and Kerensky. But the revolution itself was nonviolent. And what led to the abdication of the Tsar were the Petrograd bread riots. And they sent the Cossacks in to quell the disturbances, and instead of quelling the disturbances, the Cossacks fraternized and joined the crowd. And the Tsar had to resign on a train carriage. He never even made it back. He had to resign on a train carriage before he could make it back into the country, before he could make it back from the front. I covered the revolution, or the Velvet Revolution. I spent every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel and Klaus and Dinsbier, all the people who would inherit the government. And Havel was, for me, an extremely important figure. Started Charter 77, virtually unknown. I mean, he was a kind of non-person within his country. His plays were never performed, in and out of prison. He has a wonderful 1978 essay called The Power of the Powerless. And his argument is that our greatest strength, when we articulate a truth, what he calls living in truth, there's a kind of incongruity to it, is our powerlessness. And of course, our transparency. And during that revolution, it was driven home to me the importance of all of the acts of resistance that at the time were written off as impractical or futile. On every street in Prague, there were posters of a young Charles University student named Jan Panich, who, after the Soviet tanks had invaded Prague to overthrow Dubček and restore the pro-communist regime, had gone to Wenceslas Square and lit himself on fire. 4 days later, he died of his burns. Thousands of students marched with his body to the cemetery. They were broken up by the police. His act was never mentioned on state media. When his grave became a shrine, the communist authority exhumed his body, cremated it, and gave the ashes to his mother and forbade her from reburying them. And yet his picture was everywhere. 2 weeks after the communist government fell, 10,000 people gathered in Red Army Square in the center of Prague and renamed it Jan Panich Square. I was with those crowds, 500,000 people, on that December night when one of Czechoslovakia's most famous singers, Marta Kubashaya, walked out on a balcony before the crowd. She had sung the anthem of defiance that was broadcast over the airwaves to inspire resistance when the pro-Soviet communists regained control. Her entire recording stock was destroyed. She was never allowed to appear on the airwaves, and she existed by working as on an assembly line in a toy factory. And yet when she walked out that night and began to sing that anthem, everyone in that crowd knew every word. The Occupy movement has been knocked off balance consciously, but finally it is always the ruling elite that determines the nature of resistance. When there was that central decision to destroy those Occupy encampments, for me it was an extremely telling moment, because it showed that the only thing the centers of power, corporate centers of power, had to offer was repression, force, and violence. And many of you, I'm sure, read Krugman, who keeps calling for a rational economic policy. And he and I were both on Democracy Now! A few weeks ago. I spoke, and then Paul was on. And afterwards, I said, Paul, everything you write is true, but it's only possible if you have systems of power that are rational. Once systems of power essentially retreat, as our elites have done, into their version of Versailles or the Forbidden City, I think a writer from New York, the New Yorker, called it Richistan. Once they are totally out of touch, once they start cannibalizing themselves. I mean, there's a really great book, which I just reread, by Crane Brinton, called The Anatomy of Revolution, in which he studies several revolutions, including the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and he lists sort of the fundamental prerequisites for revolution, all of which we have fulfilled. A corrupt elite, a disempowered, a working class that keeps getting pushed further and further into misery. But at the end of that list, he says, the most important thing about revolutionary movements is that their fundamental demand can never be met by the ruling class, because it would mean their dissolution. And one of the critiques of the Occupy movement from, you know, all the courtiers on the airwaves was, what are their demands? They don't have any demands. Well, they had a very clear demand, and that is, we want to reverse the corporate coup d'etat and take back for the citizenry the power that has been wrested from our hands by corporations. But that was, of course, a message that Wall Street and its minions could never hear. The decision by the state to respond with force, for me, instead of responding rationally, which would have been a national effort, a national jobs program, massive jobs program, especially targeted at people under the age of 25, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a forgiveness of all student debt, the public option for all, that would have broken the movement in the way that the New Deal legislation broke the radicalism with the breakdown of capitalism, and as Conrad Black pointed out, saved capitalism. And so we've entered a new era. And there will be a reaction. I don't know what it will look like. Even the purported leaders, or those closest to the movement, don't know what it will look like. On November 9th, 1989, I was with all of the leaders of the East German opposition in Leipzig, and they said, maybe within a year there will be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a few hours, the Berlin Wall, at least as an impediment to human traffic, did not exist. We have a moral imperative, especially for those of us in this room who have children, because we've betrayed them, to stand up and fight for life. In theological terms, and anyone who reads climate science reports, I think, cannot dispute this, corporate forces are systems of death. They are willing to sacrifice us all. It's not a particularly new phenomena in civilizations. It happened on Easter Island. It happened to the Mayans. But this time, if we go down, the whole planet goes down with us. And I did a action a couple weeks ago in Zuccotti Park with Father Daniel Berrigan, who's 92. And as Berrigan says, we're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then we have to let it go. Faith is the belief that it goes somewhere, that the good draws the good, even if all of the empirical evidence around us show otherwise. The Buddhists call it karma. But I think that we've got to stop asking the question, is it practical? And start asking the question, is it right? And I believe that the inner workings of corporate power are so corrupt and so fragile that with the kinds of mass movements that I saw in Eastern Europe, they can be defeated. Thank you.
Good evening, sir. I have kind of two questions rolled into one because they're related. One, I'm sure you have, but have you ever read Eric Hoffer's old 1955 book called The True Believer, which is an analysis of mass movements? And in it, on Inauguration Day, I found the section on hope and change. And what do you think is the one unifying principle that we could all unite behind to create a mass movement here in America?
All of the tinder's there for the mass movement. I mean, you know, I covered the two Palestinian uprisings or intifadas, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. They all have a kind of unifying quality, which is that you know the tinder is there, but you never know what it is that will ignite it. None of us can know, but it is there. And we've just seen in the last few weeks the government deny hundreds of thousands of Americans the extension of their unemployment benefits. The Supreme Court decision that was an assault against public sector unions. I mean, it is just the refusal to fund adequately food stamps, and 6 million people in this country, their sole source of income is now food stamps. One in every three children eat in this country because of food stamps. When Clinton destroyed welfare, what, you know, sort of wasn't gotten out was that 70% of the recipients of welfare support were children. You know, corporations know only one word, and that's more. And they will push and push and push until there is a backlash. It can go the wrong way, as it did in the 1930s. And we have powerful, essentially proto-fascist movements that speak in the language of violence, that celebrate the gun culture, that direct a legitimate rage and betrayal towards the vulnerable, Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, feminists. They got a very long list. And they are backed by the most retrograde forces in our society, including the Koch brothers and others. And that's why it's extremely vital that those of us who care about nonviolence, care about an open society, begin to make sacrifices which are not comfortable. Wendell Berry, 77 years old, occupies the governor's office in Kentucky to fight mountaintop removal. And before he goes in, he goes, to be honest, going to jail is more time than I care to donate to the U.S. government. But Cornel West, Bill McKibben, they've all come to the same conclusion that we've got to, you know, to throw a wrench in the machine, and we've got to do it with our bodies.
Yep. Thank you.
Do you believe that the recent ruling by the Supreme Court regarding corporations being human beings further entrenches and codifies totalitarianism.
Yeah, I think that that 2010 ruling was it, and you can see it because they now have the capacity to essentially destroy anyone who stands in the way of corporate power. I think the recall in Wisconsin is illustrative of the tragic mistake that we don't want to make. We allowed that energy. It could have gone either way. It could have gone towards general strikes, which is where they should have gone. But they funneled it back. They funneled it back into the dead political system, what Benjamin DeMott calls junk politics. The Democrats took control. Organized labor, which has not been very good, took control. They coughed up, a retread Democratic candidate. And then, of course, the Koch brothers and everybody came in and crushed it. And it's going to be very hard for them to rebuild what they had. It's not our job to take power. All of the correctives to American democracy came through movements that never achieved formal power. If you look at the political decline that we have undergone, you would have to sort of accept that the last liberal president that we had was Richard Nixon. Because he was still scared of movements. So we got OSHA, the Mine and Safety Act. There's a wonderful scene in Kissinger's memoirs, don't go buy the book, where there's a huge anti-war demonstration. I think it's 1971. Nixon's rung the White House end-to-end with buses to keep out the demonstrators. He's standing at the window with Kissinger, wringing his hands, going, Henry, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's just where we want people in power to be.
What's your thinking on like a coup d'etat within the next year in our country with like the European Union collapsing and a $600 trillion derivatives bubble? I mean, it seems like there's so much dysfunction in the centers of power that like it almost looks like we're going to get to a Smedley Butler.
Any seismic change or revolutionary change requires a crisis. Now, unfortunately, because populist movements have been destroyed, what is actually ascendant and backed is right-wing populism, and which is very frightening. It resembles the Nazi Party in the sense that you have a right-wing populism that is backed, in the case of the Nazis, by German business interests, in the case of the Tea Party and others, by corporations. So the linchpin tends to be currency. A currency collapse. I've lived through three of them. And then the world order is turned upside down. This is what happened in Yugoslavia. The war in Yugoslavia was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. And when the currency collapses, the moral order is instantly inverted. Because all of the people who are on fixed income, who'd put money aside every month, who were living on pensions, who had fixed wages, were destroyed because their currency wasn't worth anything. And it was all the gangsters and the speculators and the war criminals who were filthy rich. And the anger in Yugoslavia was manifested by supporting figures like Radovan Karadzic, who everyone knew was insane, just out of disgust. And we're not immune from that at all. I don't take the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party and these frightening, deformed figures on the far right, I don't take them lightly, because I watched those kinds of figures become ascendant in Yugoslavia. And it worries me. I mean, so there's no guarantee that we're going to exit this with sanity.
You have such a strong grasp of historical background, and speaking of lunatic fringe, I was wondering how Ayn Rand really got her preeminent rise as the high priestess of the right in this country.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, look at who these people's intellectual foundations are. It's a third-rate economist like Milton Friedman and a third-rate novelist like Ayn Rand. It's insane. I mean, the idea that making an entire human society sacrifice itself before the dictates of the marketplace, there's nothing in 3,000 years of economic history to justify this absurdity. And yet, you know, go to any economics department in this university and it's just a big vat of laced Kool-Aid. It's crazy. You can't even get into the debate unless you buy this essentially utopian belief. And what we're watching, of course, is the breakdown of globalization. And yet, all of those figures, including the popularizers of it, like Thomas Friedman, continue to speak in a language that is increasingly divorced from what's happening. All of the promises of globalization have turned out to be a lie. And I think part of the problem, unlike Europe, is that with the destruction of the left, of populist movements, we've been robbed of the language by which we can describe what's happening to us. And it's called class warfare. Thank you.
And thank you to longtime listener Kenneth Dowse for bringing that speech to my attention by including it on his own show, New World Notes. I got a great respect not only for Chris Hedges' writing and speaking and analytical abilities, but also for the 20 or so years he worked as a war correspondent. I think it gives him a great background to understand the psychology of positions such as that in which the American people find themselves. Now, perhaps a lot of them haven't yet woken up and smelt the Kool-Aid, but increasing numbers are, just at the time that the police state is moving to rapidly automate its machinery of impression, bringing in drones and other high-tech features which it plans to be reliable. So what of the current dynamic? I think there's a lot of people imprisoned within a large social apparatus, increasingly doubtful about whether they want to be in it. Or perhaps they don't want to be in it, but they can't find a way out. There is a kind of a Stockholm syndrome. I think the linchpin of this system is money, this unholy measurement of proximity to the centers of financial power. I think most people know it's not what they want to do. They know a bleak future awaits. It's a problem of mutual trust. Not everybody has the courage of Chris Hedges or Daniel Berrigan to stand up for what is right because it's right, and never mind the consequences. I think people are increasingly getting there. I am encouraged by Chris Hedges' parallel with Honecker in the collapse of East Germany. What is needed is a positive vision. People have been schooled on how tough life is, how we all have to compete, how there's always scarcity. I think these are something of self-fulfilling prophecy. Let's go the other way. Let's look at promoting abundance. This morning I was reading about a team who graft fruit trees onto other trees in public places because it's illegal to plant fruit trees in public places. Certain people obviously don't want abundance. But let's us work on abundance from the ground up. Let's subvert the machine determined to promote scarcity and fear. This and all previous shows are available for download from our webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has encouraged you to wake up and smell the Kool-Aid, or if you're all too familiar with the smell of Kool-Aid, to point it out to those close to you that bad things await. A society that embraces the logic of finance capitalism.